This is a conversation with Ananth Krishnan, a correspondent for The Hindu, as well as the writer of the India-China newsletter, on how India sees China and China sees India. I discuss with Ananth the long history of cooperation and competition between India and China, how capitalists in both countries have integrated and not integrated their economies into one another, the geopolitical pressure points, such as Tibet and Taiwan, that threaten to exacerbate hostilities between the two nations, and the dark but important questions that go into how both nations are building a nationalism based on singular identities and the persecution of Islamic minorities. It's an important conversation with one of the best correspondents writing about China today. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog on the Arts of Travel podcast. And for print interviews on China and India, you can go to asiaarttours.com.
I'm Ananth Krishnan. I'm a journalist who reports for The Hindu, which is an English language newspaper in India. I'm based in Hong Kong and I report about China for The Hindu. And I've been living in China and Hong Kong and Beijing for much of the last 10 years.
There's a lot of issues with class that go on within outlets like The New York Times or The New Yorker. A lot of these things are coming more and more to light with pushes for unionization as well as sort of the internecine media wars that always erupt every few years between the young up-and-comers and the old vanguard. For India's media ecosystem, could you talk a little bit about how privilege, what role it has, and do some of these conversations we have about class or patriarchy and specific to India, casteism or colorism, how does that sort of shape or cause biases within India's media ecosystem, if you feel qualified to speak briefly on that?
No, I think that's a great question. And I think in India, we have been following those debates in US newsrooms. And I feel, unfortunately, Matt, I think that we really haven't come to that point in India yet. We should have, where we're having those discussions to the degree that they should be, you know, in something that we focus about, because it's frankly, it's quite abysmal. And I think the issue in the Indian context is caste. There have been numerous studies that kind of show newsroom leadership positions in India are dominated by upper caste people. There was one study in 2019 by News Laundry, which is this excellent Indian media website that monitors the Indian media that I recommend to your listeners. And News Laundry carried a survey and found out that of 121 newsroom leadership positions in India, 106 out of 121 were journalists from upper castes, and there were none belonging to the categories recognized in India as scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, zero out of 121. So I think that it's a structural problem and it needs to change. And I think that as far as the private media is concerned, which of course in India is a huge industry, and it's a very commercial, profit-driven industry, it hasn't really, I think, paused and self-reflected on this issue. I think patriarchy is something else that you mentioned. I think there was some reflection on that when India had its own kind of Me Too reckoning a couple of years ago, and the media industry in India was actually one of the industries where you probably had the most number of cases of people speaking out, because it was, I think, this an open secret that there were editors in positions of power who were abusing their positions of power. So I think in terms of gender, I would say at least there has been that discussion, which is the first step. And there were high-profile editors who faced charges or lost their jobs because all these cases came to light. So I think the discussion has been had, but I would say as far as caste hierarchies are concerned, I don't even think that conversation is being had. And that's something that India really should think about. And I think people are following how these debates sort of unfold in the US newsrooms, where I think conversations on race as well as gender are being had. And that's something for us to really think about.
Why is it important for what you do specifically for China? And just generally, why is it important if you want to understand India? Look, you got to read Indian media.
I thought about quite a bit in terms of foreign coverage of China and India and how they sort of differ and where there are similarities. And I think that there's still this notion of foreign correspondence where you have foreign journalists, say from Anglophone countries, from the US, UK, come to say China or India, spend 3-4 years there, report and then go back. And that's kind of still the model that's been in place. And I can see there's some logic to why, say, a New York Times or Washington Post would do that. I presume they want someone who understands their home audience, the US audience. But I think that, for instance, you have so many good Indian journalists, but I think that when they work for foreign media outlets, they usually end up working as researchers or assistants. And that's the same in China. And China is slightly different, where I think under Chinese laws, foreign media organizations can't hire Chinese nationals to be full-time journalists. So they have to work as what they're called researchers or assistants. But in India, there's no such restriction yet. You really don't have, you did mention some examples, but you really don't have Indian journalists who write in English, very qualified, probably understand India better than anyone else, who write in foreign media outlets. I think it's more a legacy of how media organizations have functioned and how they look at foreign correspondents. And I think at some point that needs to change as well. And I see no good reason why you don't have Indian reporters who are writing for foreign media organizations when India coverage is the topic. The people who grew up in India who understand the context far better than someone who comes in for a couple of years, does their stint and goes on to the next country, which is essentially the model of how foreign journalism works in the US and most Western countries. People aren't living in that country or invested in it. There are exceptions, but for the most part, these aren't people who are invested in that country or living there. And I think that that's why those perspectives are so important. And those are perspectives you won't get when you just come in. All of us have our own personal biases. I do too. And I think that we have to be cognizant of that. And obviously, I think when you are coming from, say, the US and you come to India, and you see that reflected in the coverage, you come with certain tropes and certain stereotypes that I think often are reflected in the work. And of course, I think it's improving. If I look at coverage now from even, say, 5-10 years ago, I think that there has generally been an improvement. But I think that whole model has to be sort of reflected upon the way journalism is done. And I'd say that with China as well. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that I am a foreign journalist in China and I've been here for 10 years now. And I still feel, even though I've been living here for 10 years, I'm just scratching the surface. Many times I still feel I'm still an outsider and I won't have a perspective and context that, say, a Chinese journalist who's been reporting for 10, 15, 20 years would have. And I think those barriers really need to come down and we'll all be the better off for it. So I think those perspectives of people in our own countries are not missing, but I think they should be given much more prominence in the way our countries are reported on.
So this is a question I've always been very interested in. I'm no fan of the Clintons or Reagan or neoliberalism at all. But I noticed a particular trend for China that is very interesting, and I wanted to get your sense on how it applies to India. So Clinton very famously believed his administration that with an economic liberalization, neoliberalization of China, political democratization would follow. That turned out not to be the case. And now we see in the rhetoric of Donald Trump and sort of in his shadow, with no clear sort of policy reset fully, Joe Biden, a very harsh, almost xenophobic foreign policy narrative of China, but an economic reality where the U.S. and China are more economically integrated than ever before. India right now has someone whose narrative powers obviously have been talked about quite a bit, and maybe we'll get into a bit of the Wizard of Oz aspects of Narendra Modi. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about if this was the case for India as well. Did we see a long arc of friendliness now to a more combative, militaristic foreign policy language? And behind this, is there in fact actually a very rich, very friendly economic cooperation between the two countries?
It's interesting to look at how the India-China sort of relationship developed. And as far as the US is concerned, you obviously had this huge moment 50 years ago when normalization began. And then, as you said, you had subsequent administrations that sort of saw the opening of the China market as this huge deal. Me personally, I'm a bit skeptical as to whether they genuinely believed that economic liberalization would lead to political liberalization. I don't think there were, for instance, people in India who ever expected that. Or was that just more a justification for American companies to go into the China market? And that was sort of the kind of justification that was given. But as far as India and China are concerned, it's kind of very different where you had ups and downs. I think many of your listeners would probably think of India-China relations in context of, say, the disputes. But actually, when the PRC was founded in 1949, 2 years after India had its independence in 1947, for the first 10 years, you actually had, for that first decade, you actually had this kind of honeymoon period and very close relations kind of forged in the similar experience that both countries had of coming out of colonialism, which was why India and China kind of ended up as being at the forefront of initially Prime Minister Nehru and Premier Zhou Enlai. You know, they were proponents of this idea of, say, non-interference in internal affairs, of the non-aligned movement, of giving a greater voice for developing countries. So you actually had this sort of shared sense of what they were as new nations. And that first 10 years, actually, you had a lot of this whole idea came about of India-China friendship, Hindi-Chini, bye-bye, as they used to say. But all of that was kind of upended when you had the 1962 border war between India and China, and that kind of put the relationship into this huge long period of deep freeze until there was kind of our own version of the Nixon moment or a reopening that began in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And we kind of look at 1988 as this pivotal moment when then Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi went to China and met with Deng Xiaoping. And in the years that followed, also similar to the US-China context, you had lots of booming trade, especially in the 2000s. It was something like $1 billion or so in the year 2000, and it's now across $100 billion. But unlike, I think, the big difference in terms of the US-China equation, and I think this gets to the heart of your question, is that in many ways, it's not as integrated a relationship where both have deep mutual interests. By that, I mean, unlike US companies that have benefited a lot from the China market, the India-China relationship has kind of generally been driven by India buying a lot of Chinese equipment, machinery, all kinds of products. It's very lopsided trade. And also Chinese companies coming into India and doing contract projects. So those were the two big things driving trade. And so you really didn't have a situation, and you still don't have a situation where Indian companies have been able to access the China market in a big way, whether it's IT or pharmaceuticals or anything else. So really, they really don't have a big stake in China in the way that big American corporations do. Even if you look at Indian, if you look at Bollywood, Indian cinema compared to Hollywood, for Hollywood, China is such a big market, but that hasn't been the case for Indian cinema. You've had occasional films that do very well, but for the most part, they are sort of focused on the Indian market and the diaspora, Indian diaspora and the rest of the world. So it's just that you don't have Indian companies with big stakes in China, so that you don't have that big driver of the relationship as you do in the US-China context. But you do have a situation where Indian companies are reliant on China for sourcing goods. And we saw that in the last 2 years, even during the pandemic, and we had this huge border problem in 2020. Even during the last 2 years, you've had huge amounts of trade still going on. And that's because of the fact that, you know, China's supply chains and manufacturing are not paralleled anywhere else in Asia. And India obviously hasn't done that at home. So you still have this huge reliance on Chinese goods. But that kind of, from the way I see it, that really kind of takes place on its own. It's not as deep and invested a relationship as you see with the US and China. So it's a very, very different dynamic because it's kind of just a buy-sell transactional kind of relationship rather than a situation where, say, Chinese companies are producing these goods in India or Indian companies are, you know, present on the ground in China.
How is Xinjiang reported on in India? And how would that differ from Kashmir reporting? And then finally, is there sort of a light bulb moment for a lot of Indian readers where when they see this, what some have called, and I think I would agree, genocide going on in Xinjiang, them seeing parallels to Kashmir? Or is sort of the nationalistic, xenophobic propaganda that I think goes into creating a lot of the mythology of Kashmir for an Indian audience? What does the reporting look like generally, and what does it look like to report on Xinjiang and to have it either draw parallels or not draw parallels for an Indian readership?
Great question. And I think that it's, I think Xinjiang and Kashmir is something that really needs academic study. And I will do my best to share my own perspectives because it's something that I have been thinking about a bit. And I've kind of always been hooked on Xinjiang. I first went there even before I was a reporter in China. I went there on a holiday in 2008. And I was just so captivated by Xinjiang because I'd never heard about it, to be honest with you. And I traveled all the way to Kashgar, and it was so close to the Indian border, yet so far. I was so blown away by its diversity. And I went back as a reporter as well multiple times after the riots of 2009. And subsequently all those changes and securitization that you've seen. And it has been paralleled, as you rightly point out in your question, with what's been happening in Kashmir as well, which I've been following from a distance, watching from China in terms of how the current government has gone about. In many ways, I think there are similarities, as you hinted at, in terms of, I would say, very, very broadly speaking, in terms of how a state is approaching the minority question. And that's I think that's like gets to the heart of the matter in Xinjiang and Kashmir. And I think that there is a valid sort of comparison to be made. There is also a valid comparison to be made in terms of, say, for instance, how independent media in both places have been treated. In Kashmir, as you also have observed, there's currently been a crackdown on journalists there. You had so many vibrant, independent media outlets in Kashmir, but I think the space for them has been shrinking. You had the situation for a long time, I think for more than a year, where you had essentially a communications clampdown in Kashmir. You had that in Xinjiang as well. So those are as far as broad sort of similarities of this very securitized approach to dealing with the minority problem. And I think that is, I think undeniably a very sort of similar dynamic playing out. But I think there are very many differences as well. I think when you look at both Xinjiang and Kashmir, as well as the broader question of, say, of how Muslim minorities have a space in India and China, I think the most sort of obvious superficial sort of fact to point out is the sheer number. In terms of, in India, you have more than 200 million Muslims who are citizens of India. In China, you have 20 million Muslims, including both Uyghurs in Xinjiang and Hui in Ningxia and elsewhere. So you're talking about 200 million versus 20 million. So I think that that whole majority-minority dynamic is very different. And I think that the other big difference in terms of that adds a huge level of complexity to Kashmir, unlike Xinjiang, which is, for all intents and purposes, it's an internal sort of issue that China is dealing with. It's not, say, disputed between two different countries as Kashmir is. And I think that has added a whole other level of sort of complexity to Kashmir, where you have India and Pakistan who fought wars over it. You've had the problem of cross-border infiltration and cross-border terrorism as well in Kashmir for decades. And that's something that has to be sort of looked at as well, where you've had an influx of, I think the Indian government has good reason to believe, say, terrorists who've been backed by elements of the Pakistani state who sort of come over across the border and carried out attacks. And you haven't had that level of, and you haven't seen that in Xinjiang, where I think most of the violence that has been reported is by the local population. So I think in that sense, it's very, as much as the Chinese government has kind of tried to frame the Xinjiang problem as a terrorism problem, I think those are very different dynamics as well. So I think there's similarities and differences. But to get to the larger question, I think that it is something that I think a common sort of sentiment and thread that I see in both India and China. You hinted at that in terms of this whole question of nationalism. And I think that in India as well, I'd say that, of course, there are journalists who are paying attention to the situation in Kashmir. But I think broadly, from my own perspective, it seems to me that I would say a majority of the Indian population would probably be generally supportive of the Modi government and what they're doing because of this nationalist sentiment that you mentioned. Similarly in China as well. And I think that that's something for us to think about. Also the related question of assimilation, of what is the sort of tension between, say, somebody's religious identity versus their national identity? Is the space for, say, a minority expression, is that shrinking in India and China? I would say yes, to a certain degree. The question that, you know, minorities have to sort of affirm their patriotism and that they have to sort of emphasize that the national identity comes above everything else. And I see that as a very similar dynamic in both places. I do think it's a fascinating sort of comparison to look at in terms of, obviously, they have very different genesis. But at the same time, I see very similar broad dynamics playing out in terms of how two different states are dealing with the question of what space minorities can have, and also how two different states are, I think, in many different ways, turning to nationalism as kind of a binding glue. And I see those similar trends playing out both in India and China, even though India is a democracy, India is a federal structure where the whatever Delhi says doesn't really have a writ that goes all over the country to the degree that you see in China, which is much more centralized. Even though you have all these very different political sort of systems, and one being a democracy and one not, there are very, very similar broad trends in both, which I think deserve further study. So I've been kind of riffing off my own observations, which I think might be superficial and not very academic. But I'm glad you brought it up, because I think it's something, I don't think anybody's looking at it. And I think that it's something that is very sort of deserving of much more detailed, granular study.
Well, we can talk about this because you're knowledgeable enough to cite the Hui. The Hui do not often come up in any of my conversations. I think I've had one interview with a Haverford College professor, Guang Tianha, who is himself Hui. And what people don't know is this is a Muslim minority in China, ethnically Han, sometimes not, but often ethnically Han, who have not endured any of the state violence and carceralization that the Muslim, the Uyghur and Turkic and Kazakh Muslims of Xinjiang have. Whereas in India, to an outsider, and this is where I'm going to ask for your expertise, it just seems like a broad-based sort of ground-up Islamophobic policies, where Gujarat might be just as violent in many ways, though that violence is administered by citizens, as what's going on in Kashmir, more sporadic, more random, but the same sort of sentiment, a broad-based Islamophobic core to a lot of the BJP's Hindutva policies. And I wanted to ask, one of them seems like, and I'm going to use an unfortunate word here, fascism, building up sort of a broad-based support centered around the othering of a minority, here the Muslim minority of India, whereas the other seems sort of authoritarianist, whereas China's social stability, I think anyone would know, my listeners would know, is a huge component of Chinese technocratic management in terms of how they govern the country. They want stability, so if we're going to do genocide, we're going to manage it. It's a very dark way to say it. So a Hui vendor is not going to experience the same sort of sporadic violence that, let's say, a Gujarat vendor may. And I wanted to ask, could you talk about these two systems of sort of persecution, one more technocratic, one more sort of ground up? And if we sort of would concur with, obviously, you having more expertise and being able to offer some nuance here, but is the endpoint sort of the same, if not genocide, something very horrible? Or do you see a China where maybe the Hui will escape, unfortunately, the Uyghurs will not. Whereas in India, because of the mode of mobilizing popular support revolves around sort of a fascist ground up needing to mobilize citizens to support Islamophobic policies by committing violence themselves. How do you see the governance of hate, I guess, in both countries? And is the endpoint the same, even if one is technocratic authoritarianism and the other is sort of ground up fascism?
You know, I think that one thing that I would say similar to both is I don't think in India that you can look at it, I think, as you sort of suggested in your question, as a national sort of phenomenon. And I will explain why, because I think that it's important to kind of, I'd say it to the degree in China as well. Sometimes we look at things from a national perspective without looking at what's happening in different states in India or provinces in China. And I think that's a very important lens that sometimes gets forgotten. In both countries, I'd say, especially in India, what applies in one state doesn't necessarily apply to another. And I think that's absolutely true of minority issues in India. If you look at, say, southern states, so I'm from Chennai in Tamil Nadu. If you look at southern states that have substantial Muslim populations and versus, say, northern states like Uttar Pradesh, where you had where Uttar Pradesh, which is BJP ruled, is, I'd say, at the center of this sort of communal issues in India at the moment, unfortunately. And where you've had attempts by the state government to use communal rhetoric, and you're seeing that in the current election campaign as well. But that kind of stuff would never work or fly, say, in Tamil Nadu, where I am, and where both the parties in Tamil Nadu, both the ruling party and the opposition, have historically over decades completely eschewed that kind of communal rhetoric. They just don't believe in it, and they know it won't work there, and the BJP hasn't made any inroads in Tamil Nadu. Similarly with India's northeast, or similarly with, I'd say even other southern states, so I think you have to look at the state level picture. It's not, I don't think that I would, it's at the moment, at least, and God forbid, hopefully it will never come to that level where it's like a national level movement in the way that I think some people might think. So that's the first point that I would make. And I would also say that I think Kashmir and Xinjiang in India and China, at least at the moment, I think are kind of unique in terms of their own very specific histories and their own specific demographic compositions in terms of the issues they're dealing with. And so far, at least, I don't think we've seen what's happening there to the degree that it's happening there being replicated elsewhere. For instance, in China, you mentioned Ningxia, where you have a big Hui population. I think there have been some moves. For instance, there has been reporting from journalists who've been there who say, for example, domes of mosques have been removed and the like, but nothing near what you've seen in Xinjiang in terms of, say, a mass internment of the entire population. So the point that I would make is to your listeners is generally to go beyond, I think, if you go beyond the sort of national characterizations, and if you go state-wise, I think you get a more richer picture of what exactly is happening, say, if you look at minority issues. But having said that, I'd say in terms of what I mentioned previously, I do think that there is a broad similar shared goal. I think the Chinese Communist Party is more explicit about it, which is assimilation. And I think that there's been a shift for those who follow China's minority policy from recognition of autonomy in the 1980s. And people that I've spoken to see it, if you look at China's ethnic autonomy law, it's actually very progressive. In the 1980s, you actually had, say, Communist Party officials tell their local level officials that they should go to these places, they should learn the language, that the media, they shouldn't force, Mandarin on these populations. And this was what was decided in the 80s. But recently you've had this sense, and I think this is a very, very similar trend in the way some people in India look at Kashmir as well, where the sort of conclusion is that recognition of autonomy inevitably leads to, say, splitism or separatism. And that is the same language that is being sort of deployed in terms of the Kashmir question and in terms of the minority question in China as well, that recognition of autonomy will inevitably lead to separatism. And I think both the Indian and Chinese states are, I think, for whatever reason, have made that argument. And I think and in different ways, I think in India, fortunately, you have checks and balances still because of the fact that you have an independent court, for the most part, because of the fact that, as I said, you have a federal system in states where you have other political parties in power that completely do not subscribe to that kind of politics. So in India, you do have those checks and balances. And I think that it will be interesting to see if there's any pushback to that in India, because I think in India, obviously, you have an electoral system. In 2024, you have another election. And it remains to be seen whether how the BJP performs and if they feel that this agenda works better than, say, going back to a development agenda, which is what some people even in the BJP would prefer the party to do, rather than go back to, say, communal rhetoric. So I think in India, there's still an open question whether there's a space for self-correction. But I think in China, they've kind of, under Xi Jinping, they very much settled on this idea of what minority space is, and the idea that assimilation is something that I think can't be questioned. So I'd say those are kind of a very, very similar broad trend that I see playing out in both places.
Within India, what has been sort of the, what's the word, national security strategy towards China in recent years? And then like a Ukraine or a Taiwan, which we'll get to in a second, or a Kashmir, what flashpoints do you see potentially emerging between India and China, if any? And because of the unique governance that both have, with a borderline authoritarianism of the BJP, and I think we can say a technocratic authoritarianism in China, if something flared up in these sort of systems that rely on strongman figures, is there a way to de-escalate them? So could you give us a bit of history, and then could you bring us up to speed about now in terms of national security concerns and potential flashpoints between the two countries?
So since 1988, which is when I mentioned that we had this big process of normalization, I'd say from 1988 until, say, even 2020, the broad model of the India-China relationship was kind of shelving differences, the main difference being the border dispute, and working on other areas of commonality like trade or even climate change and investments and things like that. And I think that broadly worked. And I think that not many people are aware that India and China share a land border that is longer than the US-Mexico land border, 3,500 kilometers in length. And the most remarkable thing about it is it's never been demarcated. It has never been demarcated anywhere. And the fact that they've generally, from 1962 onwards, barring a few occasions until, say, 2020, the fact that they were able to broadly keep it peaceful, I think is an extraordinary achievement. And I think we look back on it as an extraordinary achievement, the fact that they were flexible enough to manage an undemarcated 3,500 kilometer long border and keep it generally peaceful. I think now we are in a very sort of interesting stage of the relationship where I think that phase has now come to an end because of the fact that starting in April 2020, you have this big mobilization of troops from the Chinese side. And as far as India is concerned, they say they still aren't exactly clear why that happened. But you had, say, two divisions of the military kind of push up two forward areas along the line of actual control, which never happened. The line of actual control has broadly hasn't had forward deployments, which is one reason why they've been able to keep the peace. And then in June 2020, you had a bloody clash that led to the deaths of 20 Indian soldiers and at least four Chinese soldiers. And this was the biggest loss of life since 1967. Since the June 2020 border clash, the India-China border dispute, I think, has become the sort of central focus of the relationship right now. So this idea of keeping it shelved no longer holds. And over the last 18 months plus, they've been negotiating how to pull back troops. I think with the focus on Ukraine, this issue has kind of faded from attention, but you still have 50,000 soldiers of both sides deployed in forward areas. And I think that ultimately, I think India and China realize that this is not sustainable to have this kind of deployment, and they need to find a way to de-escalate. But until that happens, I think for the next couple of years at least, you're now in a situation where I think the boundary issue is the central, and it's a dispute, is still at the heart of the relationship. So the potential for cooperation in other fields has greatly diminished in the last 2 years. And I think that's this kind of new situation is here to stay. And I think that, so for India, that's going to be a huge priority. I think in terms of its national security strategy, China and Pakistan, one on the western borders and one on the northern borders, are the big issue for India, more than anything in the maritime domain. I think India has been working to at least keep the line of control with Pakistan more or less peaceful and stable. Now it's dealing with, I think India's biggest concern is dealing with the two-front situation, where it has a live problem with Pakistan and a live problem with China. And of course, your listeners will be aware that Pakistan and China, as far as I see it, Matt, China's relationship with Pakistan is bar none Beijing's closest relationship with any country on this planet, more than Russia, more than North Korea. More, it's an extremely close, solid relationship that covers economics, that covers military, that covers the nuclear domain. And I think that for India, dealing with how it deals with this problem on both borders is the pressing national security issue, bar none. That kind of also explains why I know some in the West are perplexed why India hasn't been vocal on Ukraine. India, along with China, have been, and the UAE, have been three countries that have been consistently abstaining on all UN resolutions. And for India, that's because of the fact, there are many reasons, but that's because of the fact that it has historically close relations with Russia. And for India, it sees its relationship with Russia as something that is very important to preserve when it is dealing with this huge problem with China. So in a nutshell, so I'd say that remains the focus of India's national security concerns at the moment, and I don't see that changing for the immediate future.
Taiwan is very interesting in that, geopolitically, in an era of authoritarianism, it's just sort of a bargaining chip. Unfortunately, and very sadly, that's, I think, how many people just sort of see it. Now, Taiwan, I'm always very interested in their strategy. They can't rely on military might. They have to rely on perhaps their key export semiconductors, as well as soft power. And the administration of Tsai Ing-wen has made an effort to reach out to counterparts in South Asia. I'm wondering, within India's foreign policy, we always hear about Japan, we always hear about the U.S. Does India have an opinion on Taiwan? And what do you make of sort of Taiwan trying to insert itself between India and China?
I think, to put it very bluntly, I don't think, from everything that I see, that India is likely to, in the near term, broadly change the way it's approached Taiwan. And India, like the US and like most other countries, has a one China policy. And I think when India recognized the PRC, just to give some context, in 1950, I think that its recognition of the PRC, if I'm not mistaken, was in many ways even less ambiguous than the US's position, which is where I think both India and the US recognize the PRC as the sole legal representative of China. But while the US, I think the word is, acknowledges China's position that Taiwan is a part of China, I think India in 1950 kind of recognized Taiwan as a part of China, and for all intents and purposes, that hasn't changed. So I think that India is highly unlikely to revisit that position, only because it has so many other problems with China, and I've spoke quite a bit on the boundary issue. And in that sense, it kind of has its plate full. And if you look at Tibet, Matt, I think Tibet is an issue which is far more in the Indian public consciousness because of the fact that we have this cultural affinity with Tibet, the fact that you've had the Dalai Lama in India since 1959, the fact that you've had this huge Tibetan community in India, more than 100,000 people. And I think it's useful to look at how India has dealt with the Tibet question to get a sense of how it may or may not deal with Taiwan in the future. And so if you look at how India has dealt with the Tibet question, I think broadly speaking, I think India has kind of gone out of the way to assuage Chinese sensitivities on the Tibet question by recognizing the One China policy as far as Tibet and Taiwan are concerned. I think the fact that generally Indian leaders don't meet with the Dalai Lama publicly, and I think that has been driven by the argument that they don't want to aggravate other problems they have with China. There is also a related argument, which is that I think there is an Indian concern that if they involve themselves in what is, quote, an internal matter of China, and I'm talking about Tibet here and Xinjiang as well, that India would similarly be kind of making itself vulnerable to having, say, Kashmir raised by China at the UN, for instance, or China doing Pakistan's bidding by raising Kashmir in international fora. That would be something India really does not want to see. So I think just to give your listeners some idea of how India approaches these questions, which is generally to kind of not involve itself in them. And I don't see that changing. But having said that, I think that even within the limitations of not having diplomatic relations with Taiwan, as you mentioned, under the new southbound policy, there has been a greater emphasis. I think that even Taiwan has been paying more attention, and where I think there will be a lot more developments that we will see, not politically, but I think certainly in terms of, say, economically and in terms of investments. You already have a huge presence of Taiwanese companies in India. I think under the radar, without people really screaming about it or talking about it, a lot happens. For instance, they're working together. They plan to work together on semiconductors. You have a big Taiwanese presence in India in terms of commercially. I think that there are sort of, there's a desire on both sides in terms of on the education front to have much more exchanges than we've seen at present. So I think leaving the politics aside, I think both India and Taiwan have a sense that they really haven't tapped the enormous potential that they have. And I think that you will see a push as you see these political problems with China. I think you will see greater recognition, for instance, say in Indian companies or Indian students going to Taiwan and those kind of linkages to a greater degree than we've seen in the past.
Having studied these two countries and their integration into global systems of capitalism and governance, what are your thoughts about the future of sort of governance on this planet and looking at the authoritarianism? And you can please clarify if that's how you see India or if there's still light at the end of the tunnel. Looking at the authoritarianism of these two countries and how quote-unquote democracies interact with them in a very friendly way, where do you think we're heading globally in terms of governance?
You know, I wouldn't really accept the proposition that India is authoritarian and will remain authoritarian. I wouldn't accept that only because of the fact that, as I've sort of tried to mention, I think that there are still significant structural checks and balances. And I think sometimes things that you may read about that may give you a sense of things being national phenomena in India,
yes,
aren't really the case. And I think that India's federal structure is still a strong bulwark against whatever anyone in New Delhi may or may not want to do in terms of reshaping the nation. And I think we've seen that even in the last 7-8 years of the current government in terms of the way regional politics have played out in India. I think that it has been a very strong indicator of the fact that it is just not possible to do that and steamroll the federal system. And even the BJP is reliant on alliances with regional parties. And it cannot push it has a very communal sort of message, say in Uttar Pradesh, where it might work for it politically. It will have to have a very different message if it's aligning with a different party in a different state. So I think these are very powerful dynamics, and I don't think they're going to go anywhere. And I think they still have been, maybe call me an optimist or whatever, or maybe colored by the fact that I live, that I spent the last 2 years in Chennai and Tamil Nadu. But I see that as being extremely resilient. And I see no reason why, I don't see the self-correcting tendencies of India's democracy. I don't think those have gone anywhere the way I see it. And I think that if time and time again, elections in India have shown an ability, even if the ruling party does not change, it does have a restraining behavior for all these conditions, for all these factors. It has a very restraining behavior on any ruling party, because they have to keep in mind different dynamics in different parts of India. And I don't think that is going to change. And I would hope that is not going to change, because it's been an integral fact of India since 1947. So I would question the notion that India is authoritarian and inevitably will be authoritarian. I don't think that is the case, because of the fact that you have these, if I can also talk about the press, Matt, there have been, I think, a lot of big Indian media houses that have been kind of co-opted mainly because of commercial reasons, I think more than ideological reasons. They've become sort of co-opted into being very soft on the government. But I think that there still is a huge vibrant media landscape in India. You've had there are many newspapers that I think still are very independent. I would like to think the one that I work for, The Hindu, is one of them as well. And I also think that you have a lot of new digital media outlets in India that are coming up and have been doing excellent journalism, and they are subscriber driven without the pressures of, say, big media houses. And I think they're doing a great job. And I don't see any diminishing outside of Kashmir, where we have to acknowledge the fact that, as we mentioned, there's been a huge silence in independent media there, which is why I kind of made the point that in many ways it's unique and not necessarily representative of the rest of India. I think generally you still have, I would say, a very sort of thriving media environment in India for the most part. And as a journalist working in India, from my own personal experience, I haven't seen anything to suggest that that has changed. As far as I'm just talking about my own personal experience, where I haven't seen that diminish in a big way. And I think that, or I would hope that that resilience in India and its political system stays. As far as China is concerned, I think it's an open-ended question in terms of how things go. I just reflecting on my own time in China, when I first went there in 2008, and you know, I was so shocked by, from 2008 to say 2013, 2014, for those 6 years, if things were far more open than I ever imagined it would be. I was blown away by it, like Weibo back in the day when it was such a vibrant place. You have stories being broken there. The big story that stays in my mind is, you know, this whole Bo Xilai scandal your listeners might be aware of. It played out in real time on Weibo when you had this police chief in the city of Chongqing rush to the US consulate seeking refuge. Because it was live sort of tweeted back in the day on Weibo, that's how everyone came to know about it. And so you did have this period of opening, I would say, and obviously that has changed post 2014. And I think living in this present moment, we tend to think that, you know, this is inevitable and things are moving in one direction. But a lot of people felt that in 2011 and 2012, that it was inevitable that China was opening up. And you had this big sort of regression, maybe again, speaking as an optimist, but from my own short, very short period of 12, 13 years being in China, reporting on it, the fact that I've seen such a big change, I think just logically speaking, you can't rule out the fact that you'll have other course corrections depending on how people in China feel about the way things are going. I think I'm ending this conversation sounding a bit maybe like a naive optimist, but I would say that I wouldn't underestimate sort of capacities of course correction, and I would at least hope those capacities to course correct are still present.
In both these countries, somewhat simultaneously, you had unprecedented protests in terms of scope and scale, with China, obviously Hong Kong, and then within India, the farmers' protests, which the Western press has done a horrible job of covering, absolutely horrible job of covering that protest in terms of how, in my mind, important it is. Could you talk a little bit about how one of these protests ended in somewhat in victory and the other in defeat for the movements, and what that perhaps tells us about the hope that you have or the lack of hope that you have for both China and India?
I think that it was an example of what I just mentioned, where I think that whichever government of the day is in India, it is not completely immune to these factors and these forces, and it has to listen to them. And I think that that was a clear example of that. I think I was in Hong Kong is quite an interesting thing. I'm currently in Hong Kong, and I was in Hong Kong for the second half of 2019. Where I was a visiting fellow at Hong Kong University at the time when most of Hong Kong University students were on the streets protesting. And I think that they are slightly different in the sense that I think Hong Kong, again, got to kind of this issue of, I mean, very, very different from Kashmir in so many ways, but got to an issue of this kind of this the status of a particular enclave within a broader country and what it should have. And for me, it was very interesting to see. I think one factor that was kind of didn't get a lot of play was how different people in Hong Kong and people in the mainland were kind of looking at it, which was something that really struck me, where I think generally people in the mainland had very little sympathy for Hong Kong, and they had the sense that Hong Kong was kind of privileged, and the sentiments were so different from what I was seeing played out in Hong Kong, where it was this kind of life in that struggle to preserve their identity, which a lot of especially young people here feel is kind of on its last legs. I think that obviously does show differences in how the central governments in both India and China operate and in terms of the pressures that they have. I think that for the central government in Beijing, there's absolutely no pressure from people in the mainland to deal with Hong Kong in a certain way. And I think that gave them wiggle room in the sense that people in the mainland would probably have been broadly supportive of how they handled it. Very different from the situation in India, where the central government has to be very cognizant of what the sentiments of people are in dealing with that. And the way they handled the farmers' protest, for instance, I think they had to be very, very aware of say, in a state like Punjab, where it would have a huge impact on the electoral prospects. So I think very, very different dynamics in play, which kind of affected how I think both India and China deal with protest movements as a whole. And I'd say even broadly speaking, when it comes to, say, freedom of expression or freedom to protest, you really can't compare the two, even though as we had seen similar tendencies, as we said, say, regarding the specific context of Kashmir and Xinjiang. But broadly speaking, I don't think you can compare the two in terms of the space that people have in India and China, especially in the Xi era. So I think the way the two protests sort of played out were very reflective of the fact that even if you have some very broad similar sort of dynamics we're seeing, such as which we've spoken about, like nationalism and the way they deal with minority issues, I think structurally, let's keep in mind that you're talking about two very different places.
Well, Anant, this was wonderful, informative, and I think for me, a very edifying conversation. Where can people find your work? And then did you have any final thoughts you wanted to share with our audience?
No, I appreciate you taking the time as well. And I enjoyed this conversation as well, as it made me kind of think through things that I usually maybe don't often write about or think about, I think, in our day-to-day job of reporting. So I cover mainly political news and foreign policy news for The Hindu. So you can find my work there. I also have a newsletter on Substack called the India-China Newsletter, where I bring out issues every week or so that kind of focus on the India-China relationship, which I still think is an extremely important relationship and one that is quite misunderstood. I think people aren't often aware of the complexities of it. I think people tend to bracket India and China in boxes, either being, you know, adversaries or rivals and the like, but I think that it's a much more complicated relationship than that. And I also try to look at, say, similar things, like similar sort of dynamics that play out in both countries. I'm thinking of writing something now on how the publics in India and China have responded to Ukraine, which is very different from, say, how many people in the West have responded to Ukraine, because I think people in India and China have, for instance, have tend to focus on the past in terms of Western interventions in other countries. So I try to look at things that go beyond the news. So if you're interested in that, you can check out the newsletter. I'm trying to be regular, but it depends on the demands of my day job.